Hello, this session will be asking the question, why be moral? What is the basis for our morality? And we're going to be contrasting the biblical worldview with that of the atheistic worldview, at least among some. In the movie Groundhog Day, there's a scene in which three men are in a car, and the driver and main character asks the others, what if there were no tomorrow? And one of them responds, no tomorrow? Well, that would mean there would be no consequences. There would be no hangovers. We could do whatever we wanted. And Phil says, that's true. We could do whatever we wanted. And then he starts driving on railroad tracks and says, I'm not going to live by their rules anymore. And of course, a real philosophy like this is not going to be about there being no tomorrow. It's really a worldview that says there's no God. And if there's no God, then at some point our time ends and there is no more tomorrow. Paul recognized this type of philosophy in 1 Corinthians 15:32. If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. That's a quote from Isaiah 22:13, a time in which God's people were acting as though God was not there and they were doing whatever they wanted. The gospel is here to redeem us from this way of thinking, but the gospel is not just a moral system. Our goal in teaching the gospel is not just to get people to change from one moral system to another moral system, because just being good morally isn't what's going to save people. All have sinned, and the only way to salvation is through the blood of Jesus Christ. Nevertheless, morals are a part of what it means to be human, and our worldview as a whole needs to support the moral nature of mankind. So what does our worldview have to do with morality? What makes morality intelligible? Which worldview legitimately accounts for moral accountability and responsibility? What is our final, ultimate foundation for morals? Everyone has a sense of ought. And that's seen in every culture and every time. What explains that? This is not talking about all the specifics of morality, but just the point that everybody has some sense of what, you know, some things ought to be done and some things ought not to be done. Whatever they are in that culture, there's still that sense of ought. And so what explains that? A foundation built on random, purposeless, amoral chance? Is that a serious explanation? Or a foundation on intention, purpose, and intelligence? Which makes sense of our moral nature? What explains right and wrong? You know, everyone has a line that must not be crossed. The only issue is what that standard is, what that line is. But who gets to decide that? Are we really just at the arbitrary whims of society? If we exist as a result of an intelligent God who made us this way, our moral nature makes sense. Because morality is one of the issues that sets human beings apart from the rest of creation. But why? Does random, purposeless, mindless chance explain that, or does intelligence explain it? And so we have a choice that really is before us right here. The biblical view of morality, of course, is built on the idea that God is at the foundation of all. He's the creator. He upholds all things by the word of his power. Jesus does, Hebrews 1 and verse 3. In him all things hold together, Colossians 1:17. God is not just a moral being accountable to a higher standard of morality than himself. He is the standard. Holiness is his nature. And as creator, he made male and female in his image. Humans are moral creatures meant to reflect God's holy nature. Humans are morally responsible and accountable for their actions. They were made to rule with God in Genesis 1:26 through 28. God gave them dominion. But sin messes that up. We are accountable to God for this. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ that we may be recompensed for the deeds in the body according to what we've done, whether good or bad. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10 tells us. Because of who God is, he has the right to tell us how to act and think. And Scripture provides principles and guidelines for moral behavior. And failing in that is what we call sin. We see the effects of that in Genesis 3 and verse 5. The lie. God knows in the day you eat of this, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Essentially is saying you get to determine for yourself what's right and wrong. And in the process of that, we rebel against the glory and character of God, and that will always end badly. But a moral sense is built into the fabric of who we are. And because of our failures to live up to the standard, we need forgiveness from the one whose will we have violated. The gospel is God's answer to that problem, that through Jesus Christ we may find forgiveness and be reconciled back to God. Our forgiveness is not based on just keeping moral laws, but upon the fact that Christ died as a sacrifice for our sins so that we may once again live. We are moral failures, and we cannot earn our way back into divine favor by doing enough good things. We need Christ. Sin leaves us broken, and only Christ, through his sacrifice, can heal those wounds with forgiveness. And that's the gospel. That's the grace of God. Now, though being moral doesn't save us, immorality, being immoral, will condemn us. I mean, we have a list of the works of the flesh, for example, Galatians 5:19-21, 1 Corinthians 6:9-11. These things will keep us out of the kingdom of heaven. Christians believe that our moral nature makes sense in the light of the God who made us this way. With God, morality matters. Actions have consequences. We're responsible, and there will be final accountability. There will be final justice. Continuing in sin means being lost, and receiving God's grace means salvation. There's really no in-between there. What happens, though, when we remove God from the picture? When God is removed, what do we see here? And there are two passages that give us some insight into that. Romans 1:21-25 and Ephesians 4:17-20. And I want to set these side by side and just kind of compare them and take a look at these and see what they have to say here. So we note here Romans 1, and I'm looking here at verses 21 and 22 first, that although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. We can compare that to Ephesians 4:17-18. Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardness of their heart. All right, so notice there the comparison that both passages talk about the futility of thinking, the being futile in their minds or in their thinking, and the futility of their minds. This is what we go to when we take God out of the picture, comes to this level of thinking. Notice again the comparison. Romans 1, their foolish hearts were darkened. Ephesians 4, they're darkened in their understanding. So again, the comparison is important there. Claiming to be wise, they became fools over against the ignorance that is in them in Ephesians 4. So again, you get a sense of where things are headed when we remove God from the moral picture. This is what we're left with, basically. And the question is why? Why does it lead us to that path? Well, I think the answer is in Ephesians 4, due to the hardness of their heart. We become hard-hearted. We decide we're going to do whatever we want to do. God is not going to tell us what to do. No one else is going to tell us what to do. We become hardened, and it just leads down this dark path of futility. And so that's kind of what we're left with when we take God out of the picture. Peter tells us in 1 Peter 2:16, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. If we have freedom, we need to live as free people, but not use it, not use our freedoms as a cover-up to do evil things, but rather to live as servants of God. We are free to be God's servants, is the point. Now, we can contrast this with what unbelievers have to say about this. Is it fair to make this contrast? Consider the fact that God often contrasted himself with the pagan idols of the times. He does this in Isaiah 40:18-26, several more times in chapters 41-46, among other places. We compare the God of the Bible and the biblical worldview over against these other ways of thinking, we can perhaps see more clearly why we are told to hold on tight to our faith. What do unbelievers say about this? Now, I'm going to just pick through a few quotes here, but just to show, to demonstrate a worldview with God removed. Not all atheists are going to say it the same way. This, you know, that's not the point. And I want to make something very clear here. We're not saying atheists cannot be moral people. They can be moral people. All of us share, again, what I would call a common grace. We all have a spark of moral ought within us. The fact of universal morality speaks to something deep in our nature that's not accounted for on the basis of raw material. But remember, all have sinned and need salvation, which cannot be accomplished just by being moral people. The issue is not whether atheists are moral or not. The issue is that they have no ultimate foundation for arguing morality other than what society tells us. The problem is in the worldview foundation here. So in quotes like this, I want you to look for terms like good and should and happiness, things that need really further definition, again, that are not accounted for by raw, brute material. From the Humanist Manifesto 2, written in 1973, we affirm that moral values derive their source from human experience. Ethics is autonomous and situational, needing no theological or ideological sanction. Ethics stem from human need and interest. To deny this distorts the whole basis of life. Human life has meaning because we create and develop our futures. Happiness and the creative realization of human needs and desires, individually and in shared enjoyment, are continuous themes of humanism. We strive for the good life here and now. And you notice words like happiness and good and what we ought to do, basically, because we don't want to distort life. Well, how do you distort life that's just been evolved randomly? I don't know how you do that. Life has meaning, they say. Well, meaning for who? Meaning why? What if I decided I don't want meaning to life? You see the problem here. Once you go this route and there's no ultimate foundation, you're going to have issues in defending this. Or there's this one. Comes from Aldous Huxley in his Ends and Means book, that the philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He's also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, he says, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a certain system of morality. And so this is a worldview that is often referred to simply as moral relativism. But it can't be applied consistently. Someone says, you shouldn't push your morals on me. Do you realize that that's a moral statement about what you should and should not do? It's a self-defeating morality about no morality. Imagine the ethics professor who argues for moral relativism but then demands that students not cheat on exams. Would you go to a doctor who professes that it's okay to cheat, to take shortcuts, to lie, to arbitrarily decide what's ethical based on his own whims? You see the problem. How do you consistently apply this? And I like to illustrate the problem sometimes by asking, why was Hitler wrong? And I'm assuming he was wrong, because I believe very clearly he was wrong. Will moral relativism stand up to that answer? Because there's no standard by which you determine what is good or bad, right or wrong. And there's no ability to speak to the issue without being inconsistent to the profession of moral relativism. For example, when Richard Dawkins was asked about this, he was certain that they couldn't come up from the Bible, but he asked, what's to prevent us from saying Hitler wasn't right? I mean, that was a genuinely difficult question, he says. Really? Is it a genuinely difficult question to know whether or not Hitler was wrong? But if that is the case, it is so only because of a worldview which, at bottom, there is no good or evil. Worldviews have consequences. Jean-Paul Sartre, who was a prolific atheist of the 20th century, wrote the following. He says, when we speak of abandonment, We only mean to say that God does not exist and that it is necessary to draw the consequence of his absence right to the end. Got to draw his absence, the reason for that, out to the end. He says the existentialist finds it embarrassing that God does not exist. Notice, for there disappears with him all possibility of finding values in an intelligible heaven. There can be no longer any good a priori, that is, from the beginning, since there is no infinite and perfect consciousness to think it. It is nowhere written that the good exists and that one must be honest or must not lie, since we're now upon the plane where there are only men. Dostoevsky once wrote, if God did not exist, everything would be permitted. And that, for existentialism, is the starting point. That's the foundation right there. Everything is indeed permitted if God does not exist, and man is in consequence forlorn, for he cannot find anything to depend upon either within or without himself. And that's where we find ourselves. Atheist Bertrand Russell says that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end which they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. That all labor of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievements must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. He says all these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Well, you notice that? Only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair. That's what you get when you remove the moral foundation. The unyielding despair that is there. Robert Ingersoll, at his brother's grave, said he had not passed on life's highway the stone that marks the highest point, but being weary for a moment, lay down by the wayside, and using his burden for a pillow, fell into that dreamless sleep that kisses down his eyelids still. Yet, while in love with life and raptured with the world, he passed to silence and pathetic dust. So again, that's what you get. You take God out of the picture, that's what you get. He says life is a narrow veil between the cold and barren peaks of two eternities. We strive in vain to look beyond the heights. We cry aloud, and the only answer to the echo of our wailing is the echo of our wailing cry. So the echo of our wailing cry. We cry aloud. We want something to be more. He recognizes there's something, you know, we want something to be more, but all we get is an echo of our wailing cry. So that's kind of what you get when you get rid of God. And to illustrate how difficult it is for an atheist to explain morality, here's what Richard Dawkins wrote about it in his work called The Selfish Gene. Now, he said this book is mainly about intended to be interesting, but it would be if you would extract a moral from it, read it as a warning. Be warned that if you wish, as I do, to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards a common goal, you can expect little help from biological nature. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Let us understand what our own selfish genes are up to, because we may then at least have the chance to upset their designs, something no other species has ever aspired to. So notice there, he wants us to unselfishly work towards a common goal, but he says if that's the case, you can expect little help from biological nature. It just doesn't give us meaning. We have to invent that ourselves, basically, and upset nature. Well, is that the way it really is going to work? Then in his book, The River Out of Eden, he says, in a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication. Some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. There's the worldview statement right there. At bottom, foundationally, there's no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but pitiless indifference. Well, it's like one cynic said, he says, God is dead, Marx is dead, and I'm not feeling too well myself. But those who tout nature alone as the determiner of everything are going to have a tough time explaining morality. Brute naturalism is incapable of explaining one of the most important features of what it means to be a human being, and as a total worldview, it's found wanting. Alex Rosenberg presents another attempt at an atheistic explanation of morality. In The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Enjoying Life Without Illusions, he argues that we're all basically committed to the same morality and values, and he calls that good news, ironically. However, he then argues that there are not any right answers to moral questions. He says real moral disputes can end in lots of ways, by voting, by decree, by fatigue of the disputants, by the force of example that change moral social mores, but they can never be resolved by finding the correct answers. There are none. Further, he writes, nihilism is not about moral relativism or thinking about it that anything is permitted and nothing prohibited morally. Rather, nihilism denies that there is any such thing as intrinsic moral value. Nihilism rejects the distinction between acts which are morally permitted, morally forbidden, and morally required. Nihilism tells us that we can't know which moral judgments are right, but they're right, but that they're all wrong. So again, in nihilism, there's nothing good or bad in itself. He just argues then that scientism, that is, science must be the determiner of truth, cannot avoid nihilism, so we just have to make the best of it. Why then do we have morals? Because according to this view, it's the way that we evolved in order to survive. Our moral code has consequences for survival. He writes, our core morality isn't true, right, correct, and neither is any other. Nature has just seduced us into thinking it's right. It did that because that made core morality work better. Our believing in its truth increases its moral genetic or its individual genetic fitness. But what's interesting is that in that discussion, how often he uses terms like truth, right, and wrong. In other words, while denying moral values, he places value terms on what he believes is our moral core, all the while claiming that our core morality is not true, right, or correct. He even acknowledges that natural selection is not very good at picking out true beliefs, especially scientific ones, and that there is strong evidence that natural selection produces lots of false but useful beliefs. They're false, they're useful, but they're false. And that natural selection sometimes selects for false beliefs and sometimes even selects against acquisition of true beliefs. Well, if that's the case, how can you trust that anything is true or false? So we're supposed to believe that this version of reality is true and that other versions are wrong, even though all judgments are said to be wrong, which is itself a judgment. Are moral values real, or are they illusory? Now, Proverbs 10 and verse 25 says, when the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. We need to be consistent with morality. If morals are illusory, then they aren't real, and there's no possible way of knowing right from wrong. That's a position many unbelievers have placed themselves in. Moral values are not material things extended in space and time that can be seen and touched and tasted or heard or smelled in any physical way. No raw material object as necessary characteristics has moral values. But moral values are either real or they're not. If reality is only material, then moral values are an illusion. And if it's an illusion, then ultimately they don't really matter, for they wouldn't be real, and any moral judgments for any reason whatsoever would also be illusions. And if anyone doubts that some take that position, this is from Michael Ruse, an atheist from or an agnostic from Florida State University. And he had to say this. He says, morality is a biological adaptation no less than hands and feet and teeth. Considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims, ethics, he's talking about, is illusory. I appreciate that when somebody says, love thy neighbor as thyself, they think they're referring above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, to a Darwinian evolutionist, it can be seen that such reference is truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction and has no being beyond or without this. So he's saying morality is just an ephemeral, temporary product of the evolutionary process, just as our other adaptations. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any other deeper meaning is illusory, he says. Well, that means, you know, ultimately it's going to be meaningless. Yet we also have to ask, if all of this is just a product of evolution, why did immorality develop? If it's an illusion, wouldn't this mean that evolution has tricked us into thinking that one of the most fundamental aspects of being human is really false? I could show you other places where atheists like Sam Harris say free will is an illusion. Morality is an illusion. Free will is an illusion. The most fundamental aspects of who we are said to be illusions. But how can we trust any knowledge that would allegedly come from that kind of a system? There's a failure then that comes in with moral relativism. And again, by moral relativism, I mean in this context that morals are merely human conventions that are relative, not absolute. They change according to our personal or societal situations and desires. Morals are subjective with no ultimate line or standard by which moral behavior is to be judged other than what we decide. But we live in a confused culture. We've been told for many years morality is relative. Then when we see an obvious injustice, morality is no longer relative. Think about that for just a moment, and nor should it be. We've been told we're products of evolution, that God is dead. Then when people act without a moral foundation, we wonder how this happened. We're clueless to the reasons why we become so greedy, so brutish, so vile, so murderous. We become the epitome of Paul's list in 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. We reap what we sow. There's a failure to that kind of system. And again, the moment somebody says, you shouldn't push your morals on me, just ask them, are you pushing yours on me? Are you telling me what to do and what not to do? That's part of the problem. And we can't afford to gloss over this. Can one be good without God? Is good even a real thing without God? What are we talking about here? Well, I think we have to couple that with this. What's the basis for moral outrage? What's the basis for calls to justice? You know, C.S. Lewis made this statement. He says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh in honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. This was years ago. It's gotten much worse now, but let that sink in. Why is something evil? Why is racism evil? Why is it wrong to sexually harass another human being? Why is it evil to oppress the weak? Why? I believe they're wrong because we have a God who made us in his image. If we can't provide legitimate answers to that, all we can do is shout out personal preferences and continue to be frustrated at our failure to understand why the world is as it is. The heart has been removed, but we still expect it to beat. We're dead, but we don't know it. Again, I'm not saying unbelievers can't be moral. I'm saying what they don't have is a foundation for it. And we're collectively reaping what we sow. We're at a point, I believe, where we can, with Daniel, pray. Daniel 9, 8 through 10, to us, O Lord, belongs open shame. to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, because we've sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong mercy and forgiveness, for we've rebelled against him and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God by walking in his laws, which he set before us by his servants, the prophets. Think about how important it is. All of these questions deserve answers that are based upon moral foundations, not based upon a foundation that at bottom there's no good or evil or right or wrong. But the fact of morality, the fact of moral outrage, the fact of the desire for justice, all of these things show that built deep within us is a desire to reach out for something greater as a foundation. Now, let me stress once again, we've all been the moral failures. And we're not saying here, by talking about moral issues, that Christians are perfect, by no means. We're Christians because we recognize our failures and we need forgiveness. And we believe in a God who is gracious and merciful and who brings that forgiveness. I don't earn my way into salvation by being morally good. Nobody does. Jesus didn't die just to save people who change moral positions. He died to offer grace and mercy and forgiveness, and that requires us to admit our failure and come to him in humility. But then also at the same time, as we enter into covenant relationship with God, be dedicated to doing what is right, to doing his will. So I urge you to think about these things. There's a lot more that can be said about moral issues, of course. But think about the reason. Ultimately, the reason why we need to be moral is because we're made in God's image to reflect him, to reflect his holiness, and to glorify him. And we can't do that when we act immorally. So think about that, and think about how important this is. And I thank you.